The former president and chairman of American Airlines is nostalgic for the days of airline regulation. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Poole, Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. Reason is a group which promotes free market solutions to problems rather than government intervention, and that often has a lot to do with air travel, especially in the airline industries. Bob, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners today.
Glad to be with you, Paul.
You had a couple of things of great interest to me in the June issue of Airport Policy News. One of them was your comments on Bob Crandall's comments regarding the 30th anniversary of airline deregulation back in 1978. I think that you were kind of taken aback, as were some others in the industry, with the extent to which Bob Crandall seemed to be pushing back toward the days of regulation.
Right. I mean, his rationale for, I think the headlines were exaggerated because he didn't call for bringing back the old Civil Aeronautics Board that totally controlled who could fly where and at what price. Mm-hmm. But he did say that he used the same arguments that were used to justify that system, that airlines more resemble public utilities, which we in this country regulate as monopolies, than they do ordinary businesses, and that the 30 years of deregulation shows that it's a failure, and that airlines can't really make money if they're in constant competition. And so he did propose some brand new federal intervention of several kinds that I think would be a real step backward toward the dark old days of the CAB.
Well, now there are a couple of questions that come to mind when you get into that kind of argument. One is the idea that the airlines and the airports can't make money without regulation. And I look at that industry and I see, if anything, an industry which hasn't figured out yet how to make money, partially because they have this baggage of regulation. I mean, they were protected in ways for a long time.
That's right. I mean, that's why we call carriers like United and American legacy carriers.
Right, right.
They do carry with them the legacy, and unfortunately, despite almost, there's virtually a complete turnover. Nobody who was a senior manager at the time of airline deregulation is any longer still on the job in a senior manager. They've all long since retired.
Right.
But still, the corporate cultures don't seem to have fully evolved to cope with the dynamics of a truly competitive industry with open entry, which is what airline deregulation brought about. And it's that competition, that continuous competition, is what has led to the dramatic decline in real fare levels on average that has opened up the airline market. You know, the market today for who flies is nothing like it was when I was a kid growing up, working in an airline, growing up in an airline family, the late lamented Eastern Airlines, and flying on passes. Mm-hmm. Load factors in those days were 50%.
Right.
And you could always get seats. Usually, even in my early career, flying on business in the early first few years of deregulation, you could almost always count on the middle seat in a three across thing being empty. And often on night flights, you could, on a wide body, you could stretch out across five seats and sleep. But those days are now gone. It really has changed because competition has opened up the market so that basically everyone can afford to fly.
You know, I remember back in the early 70s when People Express Airlines started operating.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And you could fly from, if you flew from Bozeman, Montana to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, it went through Newark, New Jersey.
right.
And I mean,
a sort of extreme hub and spoke system.
Yeah, it was like a hub and spoke system on a really large bicycle.
Right.
But I do recall at the time that, their fares were so low that mm-hmm. I actually heard people complain who were, frequent flyers at the time. They'd say, Paul, they're turning it into a bus with wings.
Well, that's right. And that's exactly what they did. That was Freddie Laker's genius idea, too, across the Atlantic. And, the legacy carriers hated Freddie Laker and tried, to get government to somehow regulate him out of business because they just, with their high embedded cost structure, they just couldn't compete with the kind of fares he was able to charge.
Well, how far back toward regulation do we need to move? I guess that's maybe even a bad way to put it. But
what are the problems that need to be fixed to make the industry more viable?
And I know this will be an interesting question for you. What role could government play in that process?
Yes. You know, and I'm no anarchist. I believe in government. Government has a role to play in setting the basic even-handed rules of the game for, you know, for all companies, all for-profit endeavors. Well, I think two things are that Crandall cited are indeed problems with the current government role. One is the bankruptcy laws that under Chapter 11 allow the walking wounded to continue to operate and not pay their bills and to charge low fares and compete with companies that have to pay all their bills. And I think there's really something wrong with that. I'm not an expert on bankruptcy law, but it clearly, in the case of airlines, where some airlines have been through three or more Chapter 11s and are still around, that is really seems like government intervention to protect carriers that the market is saying your business model stinks and you should be a failure. I think we need to fix that, and I'll leave it to people who know more about the legalities to suggest you know what the right fix should be. The second is the labor laws the labor laws today that airlines operate under, and again, I'm no expert on labor law, but it gives a huge bargaining power to the unions because the threat of a strike the reality of a strike can just about put a carrier out of business. I mean, under the old in the CAB days of regulation, there was something called a mutual aid pact, where if one airline experienced a strike and had to cease operations for the duration, the other airlines had all the airlines had kicked into a fund, and for the purpose of providing some revenue during a strike to the struck carrier so that it could survive. That's gone. That doesn't exist any longer. So the unions in aviation, I think, have the carriers by the throats. And that means that the threat of a strike is so serious that the airlines give away too much still, even though it's not as cushy for the unions as it was in the days of regulation, when all the cost increases could just be passed through as higher fares because there was no competition on fares. It still gives them an undue bargaining power. And what the low-fare carriers, low-cost carriers like JetBlue and AirTran and Southwest have shown is that labor work rules are really the key. It's not so much those carriers. Now, Southwest, I think, has the highest pilot salaries in the country.
Right.
But they also get more work out of the pilots and more flexible work rules, and that's true across the board with mechanics and other aspects of the labor market in airlines. The greater flexibility in work rules, who can do what, means big differences in productivity typically between the legacy carriers and the low-cost carriers.
Bob, while we're on the topic of airlines versus unions, I want you to hold that thought for a moment because I have a question for you after the break. My guest is Bob Poole, Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. I'm Paul Plack, and you are listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR22 GTS, Cirrus's premium luxury ride that has come to define Cirrus aircraft as one of the world's elite. Every dream option from supple leather seats to an exhilarating 310 horsepower performance and speed come standard, giving new meaning to the phrase fully loaded. When flying the SR22 GTS, getting there is truly more than half the fun. To learn more, call 888-750-9000 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design. Clarity Aloft headsets employ patented Comply Canal tips, composed of soft viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. More than simple earplugs, these foam tips provide full-spectrum noise reduction and outstanding attenuation. This advanced technology is lab-tested, proving that viscoelastic passive noise reduction is superior to active noise reduction. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking with Bob Poole of the Reason Foundation. We've been talking about the legacy carriers and the unions and how the unions maybe have too much power. Let me ask you a devil's advocate question,
okay.
or at least I guess if you're an airline, I'm the devil on this one. What about this idea of going bankrupt and walking away from obligations you've made to your workforce? Because one of the things that I see happening that that shocks me is that essentially, you know, people who have worked for decades in some cases under the assumption that they had a pension plan,
right,
are suddenly out on the street in an industry where you're forced out the door legally at age 65.
You know, that's a very tough situation, and again, there's it's probably beyond my legal knowledge to really say what could be done about that. I don't know if that situation is much different, though, from, let's say, a steel mill that shuts down, an auto plant that shuts down. I mean, you mentioned, for pilots at least, the mandatory retirement age, but that's I think, the exception as opposed to, I don't think there's a mandatory retirement age for mechanics or most other airline employees. And so I don't know that it's in a fundamental way different in airlines than it is in most other industries. And if one a company or a facility shuts down and the people are laid off at age 60, and because the company goes out of business, that is very, very tough. And that is why we have, you know, the government has the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which, while I think it shouldn't be a government thing, it's a good thing there is that kind of a safety net to provide something for people whose companies have gone belly up and left them without their pensions.
Yeah, although that's a safety net with some pretty big holes in it.
Oh, it is. So that's a whole other topic for discussion
right. For
another day.
Well, still on the Bob Crandall comments, let me ask you, Bob seems to echo some of the things I hear from people who travel Europe and other parts of the world quite a bit, and that is that there should be a role for high-speed rail in relieving short-haul routes that are currently the exclusive turf of airlines. Environmentalists like this idea, too, because obviously you can move people on the ground on wheels with far less carbon emissions and all the other pollutions than you can through the air. And I know I'm going to get emails now for calling carbon pollution.
But anyway, that's the world we live in now, Paul.
Yeah, and I guess I get into the same discussion on this versus air travel as I do when you start talking about railroads versus the interstates, and that is, if we had invested in rail the amount that we have invested in interstate highways, we'd have a very different world. Why is it not the same argument in rail?
Right, but here's the problem, though, and I get this argument because I work on surface transportation as well as aviation policy.
Right.
If you actually look at who's paying for what, the highway system, particularly the interstate highway system, is self-supporting from the user taxes paid by the people who drive on the highways. Likewise, the commercial aviation system, private planes, but the commercial aviation system pays its full way for the airports and air traffic control that they use. Now, they don't pay directly for the safety regulation, but no other industry pays for its safety regulation either. That comes out of general federal taxation. On the other hand, passenger rail is, in this country, given the generally long distances, is completely unable to support itself. And even if tax money, general tax money now, from everybody, not from users, but from all taxpayers, is used to build high-speed rail lines, the estimates are, and they may be wrong in a few dense corridors like New York to Washington, but in general, the estimates are that not fares that would be competitive with airfares could not cover even the operating and maintenance costs if the capital costs were free. And the capital cost is billions and billions and billions of dollars.
Right.
So, I mean, there's a real difference. Yes, there is some energy efficiency, you know, a certain amount of BTUs per passenger mile. High-speed rail would do somewhat better. It's not as big as people think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the carbon emissions is proportional to the energy efficiency.
Right.
But the other question is, you know, we didn't do it 50 years ago.
Right.
And
right.
Land is now occupied by other stuff that in the places, the precise places, the 200 to 300 mile apart cities where there's enough density that the trips might be competitive with flying on a time basis,
mm-hmm.
Those are precisely the places where the land is so expensive that the infrastructure would cost tens of billions of dollars, and it would have to be paid for by general taxpayers, not by the users. So I just don't see it as you know, you're not talking about apples versus apples. You're talking about aviation and highways being in those intercity markets being self-supporting from fees and user fees and user taxes paid by their users, whereas the rail alternatives would have to be heavily subsidized by general taxpayers. And why should someone in Montana mm-hmm. be taxed to pay for high-speed competition with airlines in New York to Washington?
You know, when I look at what President Eisenhower's stake in this was, I have to observe that he was a general. And he understood that the interstate highway system had a great strategic military value under certain scenarios.
Very true. Very true.
However, I wonder if he had any clue what he was signing in terms of the way.
I suspect that I don't think anybody really could have envisioned how what a huge transformation the interstate highway system would bring about for America. I mean, it basically allowed the creation of long-haul trucking industry
right.
that truly became competitive. Now, admittedly, the long-haul trucking is part of the highway user group that doesn't fully pay its way, because the big heavy 80,000-pound trucks do a lot more pavement damage than cars, and they should be paying more. If they paid more, we could afford to build sturdier highways in
right.
those corridors. But apart from that, I mean, this is 85% of the value of all the goods that we use in America, wholesale and retail, go most of the way by truck,
mm-hmm.
and that the flexibility that has given us. It has permitted the creation of just-in-time logistics systems, because one of the failings of rail today, here we are in 2008, rail still cannot offer guaranteed delivery times.
Right, right.
Whereas trucking can, and trucking lives by that. And that's a huge difference that it's made possible, dramatic. It's the cost of logistics for most of American business has been cut by about 40% over the last 15 years, thanks to the third-party logistics and just-in-time delivery and these things, which would be impossible without the truck freight network that we have.
Well, and when you get outside industry and people are making summer vacation plans now and trying to decide whether they can go someplace based on gasoline prices,
yes.
I have to observe that if you're going someplace with your family, you know, right now, if you decide you want to leave at 4 o'clock in the morning to beat rush hour, you get in your car and you do it. I think maybe we have created a culture which may never go back to trains.
I think that's right. People really have learned that they have the autonomy and flexibility to go when and where they want. Even with the traffic congestion during certain times of the day in urban areas, people learn to work around that. And that also is a solvable problem with electronic road pricing, but that's a whole other story, too.
Well, and maybe a whole other Aerocast at some point.
Right.
Bob Pohl is the Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. Bob, what's the best way for our listeners, if they're not familiar with your newsletter, to find out more about it?
They can go to www.reason.org, that's .org, and look under by subjects area of airports and air traffic control. And there's a complete archive of my newsletters there.
All right. Well, Bob, I find them fascinating reading, and a lot of times you pry up rocks that nobody else commenting on this pries up. So we really appreciate it. And thanks for taking some time out today.
Thank you, Paul.
Bob Pohl is the Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.